actual completion of the Battle of Armageddon. What's so fascinating is that, normally you just have this God man. He bursts forth from heaven in flaming fire and so forth. You think all the people of the earth at that point would, be repenting or whatnot, but it actually says the beasts and the kings of the earth go up to make war with him. And so I've always said, well, what in the world, are they thinking that they can actually make war with Jesus after his return? Until I really began to understand Islamic apocalyptic expectation. And so what Muslims are actually taught, according to their prophecies, is that you have this false Messiah. They call him the Dajjal. He comes back and he rides across the sky on a giant white donkey. And he's really the Antichrist. He's the false Messiah. He's the Jewish false king. And so really that's the pinnacle of the victory of the Muslims in their expectation that they believe they're going to kill this evil imposter. And so it would not surprise me at all if that would be one of the motivations driving the beast and the kings of the earth in the last days, is that when Jesus returns, a lot of the kings of the earth, the kings of the land, if you will, are actually believing that he's just the Antichrist. And of course, the scriptures say that he'll slay them with the breath of his mouth. But again, I don't believe that happens instantaneously upon his return. I believe that he will carry out his victory over a brief period of time before he takes his throne in Jerusalem. And then, of course, the one other element that I would add is Jesus, of course, at the end of the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24, he's just described this time of unparalleled tribulation, specifically for those that are in Israel, in Jerusalem and Judea. And then in Matthew 25, he says that he's going to sit as judge, and he's going to gather the nations to the Valley of Jehoshaphat, which, of course, is the valley that is just east of Jerusalem, in between the Mount of Olives and Jerusalem that runs north and south. He's going to sit as judge, and he's going to separate the sheep from the goats. Well, and then he said that he's going to judge them based on how they treated his brethren. Well, what a lot of people don't realize is what Jesus was actually doing was pointing out, he was elaborating on and explaining Joel 3, which is where the Lord, Yahweh says, I'm going to gather the nations to the Valley of Jehoshaphat and judge them. And so when Jesus says that, he says, I'm going to put the goats on my left. He's actually pointing to the Valley of Gehenna, and which, of course, is the location that he always used for that place of eternal punishment. And so when Jesus says, my brethren, the context, of course, in Joel 3 is Israel, my people, my inheritance, Israel. And so he just explained that this time of unparalleled tribulation for those in Jerusalem and Judea. Now, of course, the Great Tribulation is going to affect Christians throughout the earth, but the ultimate context of this sermon really was very Israel-centric. And so something happens at the end of the age that is so dramatic that he's actually going to be able to judge the nations based on their response of how they treated his people, his inheritance, in their darkest hour. And so the Messiah comes back in many, many ways as the deliverer of all God's people, but ultimately as the deliverer of his people, Israel. And so much of it is a very, Israel-centric picture, as you pointed out.
Okay. Well, very good. So does anybody have any thoughts or comments or questions on that? I have one that I know at least one or two others are thinking, and that is, and you kind of addressed it, but what about like the verse where it says, let me just look at it, it's in 2 Thessalonians, where the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. You kind of mentioned that, and you said that basically that's it's not an immediate thing.
Well, it's got a handful of verses that speak of the Antichrist being killed. In Daniel it says, I saw the little horn, he kept speaking boastfully until the body of the beast was destroyed and given to the fire. You've got that the Antichrist, I think that's 2 Thessalonians, where it says that he'll be slain by the brightness of his coming, by the breath of his mouth. And then, of course, you've got Revelation. So you've got a handful of different passages. And really, in order to understand the full picture of what's going to take place, you need to take into consideration all of the full context of all of these passages. And if you just read that passage in isolation, I think, you know, you could come to the conclusion, well, as soon as he comes back, you know, it's just the brightness of his coming blazing. But I think in light of all the other passages, that needs to be looked at in a slightly, I guess I'll just call it a poetic, prophetic dramatization. In essence, it will be by his return, but that doesn't mean at the moment of his return, obviously, because there are other passages that that show that to be otherwise.
Right. Okay. Well, Sue, and then anybody else have anything before we go to the next next question?
Hi, this is Tom.
Hey, Tom.
I just wanted to make a comment that the return of Messiah is at the end of the last 3.5 years of tribulation. And then that's when the resurrection of the dead and the saints that are still alive are raised to meet Messiah in the clouds at the last trumpet. So that's the end after 3.5 years of tribulation. And the series of, there's actually three wars, major wars. They call them woe, woe, woe. And just before the time of Messiah's return, that's just when the second woe has already begun. And it's when the Middle Eastern countries rebel against the beast and attack Europe. And so that's why the beast power moves up towards Megiddo to meet the armies that are coming from the Middle East. So the reason why the beast power is up at Megiddo at first is just to battle with the coming armies. But when Messiah returns, then the dull armies of the world see him in the clouds. So they're already gathered near Megiddo. Instead of battling each other, they march on Jerusalem, where Messiah is returned to. So that's one reason why the armies are there in the first place, and why they march on Jerusalem is their own madness. They're coming to battle each other, but instead they battle the Messiah.
Okay. What are your thoughts on that, Joel?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a thousand different teachers and theories in terms of all of the various specific battles. I think everyone has their theories. I'm always careful to be overly specific. You know, you can have these various timeline charts and you can glue it to your ceiling above your bed and memorize it and still be confused after a year.
Right.
I'll hear one teacher lay out his scenario and it makes sense, and then you hear the next guy lay out a completely different scenario and that makes sense too. So I'm open to, you know, all these different ideas, but in terms of the real specifics, but I'm also of the opinion that we need to be careful. We need to be hold a lot of these real specific scenarios lightly and just maintain a humble attitude with regard to the specifics. On the general picture, I think we all agree, you know, the gist of what's going to take place. And I agree in terms of the resurrection taking place at the end of the tribulation. Now, that's why I said I'm somewhere in between pre-wrath and post-trib. Pre-wrath, I think, has the tremendous strength of highlighting the cosmic signs as the time of the return. But by the same token, I have some difficulties with the idea that that takes place prior to the completion of the 7 years. So that's why I say I'm somewhere in between. I think the pre-wrath position has done a good job of highlighting some of the events that follow the return of Jesus, answer some of the questions that post-trib really hasn't been able to answer. But by the same token, I think pre-wrath still has some room for development. So I just, you know, say in general, I agree with that theory as well. But yeah, just in terms of real detailed scenarios, this army, that army, I can, you know, point to different passages, Daniel 11, the king of the north, the south, and then even just sort of the larger potential for Daniel 8, which I guess we'll touch on next, to be speaking of a few regional wars.
Yeah.
I think it's okay to speculate and consider these things. You need to be careful and humble.
Right. Well, you know what? If you don't mind, we'll just go right into that. And that's basically the kind of the question would be what's happening in Iran and Iraq right now, and what, how do you see that fitting in and stuff? So if you don't mind just going right into that, that'd be awesome.
Can I ask one question?
Okay.
Here?
Oh, sure.
Revelation 16 talks about the false prophet the beast. And you see the seven last plagues. I'm a Seventh-day Adventist. We see the seven last plagues as happening after the before Christ coming, actually. How do you see that there being a false prophet there and a beast there? And who would he be battling if there weren't God's people there? I just was curious as how you see 16.
Well, you've got the false prophet introduced in Revelation 12 and 13. And then in 17 and 18, he's detailing Mystery Babylon, culminating with 19, obviously, his return. I'm trying to get to your question is, who do I believe the false prophet is?
Yeah, that would be really good, interesting to me. I was kind of seeing how you see Revelation 16 as if it happens before, if the plagues fall before Christ comes, are God's people still here, or is it after? How do you see that?
Let me actually pull it up in front of me.
Yeah, if you would.
Okay, so
Revelation 16.
The bowls of wrath. Yeah, okay, the bowls of wrath. I would tend to see the bowls of wrath being poured out after Jesus returns. Now, again, with regard to the seals, the seals, the trumpets, and the bowls, this is another one of these things where, you know, you've got some folks that see them as recapitulations, but they're actually just overlapping on one another. You've got some that see them as essentially concurrent, and then those that see them as following one after the other. I tend to lean towards seeing them as coming after. So the bowls of wrath coming after the seals come first and then the trumpets now. Again, I've heard some excellent teachers lay out the case for each one of these different scenarios and make quite a good case. And so I'll be honest with you, my general perspective on the end times is probably 90% formed based on the Old Testament prophets. And then on top of that, through Jesus' all of the discourse, and then the Apostle Paul's addition to those things. And Revelation, obviously, informs a lot of my perspective, but I don't begin with the book of Revelation. And I find that a lot of folks, in terms of their end time, it's all about the book of Revelation, and then they kind of go back and touch on the prophets a bit. But I think there's danger in that, obviously, because it is such an apocalyptic book in terms of symbolism and so forth. And so I allow the book of Revelation to be sort of that the book that brings together what has already been established. And so in that, I'm cautious in terms of being, again, real specific in terms of timelines and different things like that with regard to the seals, the bowls, and the trumpets. So I guess my answer is I would lean toward that taking place after the return of Jesus, but I don't have your very, very firm conviction on those things.
Okay, and then you said, I'll let you get right into Cole's, but I was, after you said that, who do you think the false prophet is, and who do you think the beast is?
Well, of course, I believe the beast is the Antichrist. Now, of course, in the book of Revelation, the beast is, in a sense, it's Satan. In a sense, it's the spirit that comes to animate the man, the individual, who is the Antichrist. So there's almost that telescoping, element where the Antichrist and Satan, same thing with Isaiah 14, it's almost as if they're merged into, one another. But I certainly do believe the Antichrist is a man who then comes to be essentially possessed by Satan. So I personally believe that the Antichrist will be from the Islamic world, from the Middle East. I don't believe that the Antichrist will be, for instance, Pope. I don't even believe that he'll come from Europe. As far as the false prophet, there's been various suggestions. I would, again, tend to see the false prophet as being a Muslim as well, although there is the possibility that the false prophet could be a Christian or even an apostate Jew of some sort that's working alongside some sort of a Muslim leader. I'm open to that possibility. It's interesting that one of the elements of the, what the scriptures say with regard to the false prophet, said, beware of false prophets in a general sense. They come to you as wolves in sheep's clothing. Also here, with regard to the quintessential false prophet, it's Satan. You know, it's again the quintessential wolf, but he is dressed as though he is the ram of God, if you will. And so there is the sort of possibility that the false prophet will claim to be Jesus himself. And, you know, again, I'm not dogmatic on that, but what's interesting is that when you look at Islamic apocalyptic expectations, first of all, they believe that there'll be this figure known as the Mahdi, that's their primary Messiah figure. They believe he'll be the final caliph, that's sort of the Pope, President, General of the whole Islamic world all wrapped into one. And then they believe that he'll have an assistant, and this assistant, they believe, is Jesus Christ, but they believe that he's a Muslim. So it's sort of the Muslim version of Jesus comes back, and they're taught that this Muslim Jesus comes and tells all the Christians of the world, essentially, that we've had it wrong all along, and that our scriptures have been corrupted, that he never died on a cross, he never claimed to be the Son of God, all of these things, that he is Jesus, he's come back, and he was a Muslim. All Christians need to essentially become Muslims and follow the Mahdi, follow the final caliph, give their pledge of allegiance to the caliph, because he is essentially the representative of God on the earth. So there's that strong possibility that the false prophet and the Antichrist will in fact be to the Muslims of the world, that their prophecies have essentially set them up to receive the Antichrist and the false prophet, believing that these are sort of these end time prophets and leaders. Now again, I don't know that it will play out that way, but I can certainly see the hand of Satan in the world's largest, fastest growing religion that just happens to dominate the geographic biblical, you know, context of where all these prophecies are pointing. So, you know, again, I don't know who the false prophet will be, but I think that there's a strong possibility he could be that, you know, Muslim false prophet. They claim to be Jesus, or it could be some sort of an imposter, a Jewish or apostate Christian false prophet as well.
Thank you. I think you answered my question.
Good deal.
Okay.
Well, super. Well, then, do you want to just
jump into
to Iran, Iraq, and
okay,
a little bit on that? If you don't mind, that'd be great.
Okay. So what's so fascinating about what's taking place right now in Iraq, of course. Now, let me just say, in a lot of ways, this didn't take a lot to foresee this coming. It's actually been a few years now that people have talked about just understanding sort of the geopolitical arrangement of the Middle East to see Iraq being broken up this way. It's you know, in terms of the different sects, the Sunnis, the Shia, and the Kurds in the north, in a lot of ways it was inevitable. But with regard to biblical prophecy, you know, and I've just been peering into the book of Daniel. I mean, I've been pretty much parked there for a few years just in this book. And what's clear to me is that when you look at primarily Daniel 8 as well as Daniel 11, the most significant type of the Antichrist in all of Scripture, really the most prominent historical foreshadow of the Antichrist, is Antiochus Epiphanes. And so you have this Greek ruler, if you will, that ruled specifically. He had two capitals. One was Antioch, which is in modern-day Turkey, right on the border of Syria. But his other primary capital was Nineveh, which is modern-day Mosul, which is, of course, what most of which was just taken over by the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS. And so, personally, I've always looked to this part of the world. Now, of course, Antiochus Epiphanes ruled over what was called the Seleucid Dynasty or the Seleucid Empire, which included, you know, a large section of Iraq as well as Iran, and then all the way up to a large section of Turkey as well. And so, this general region, I'm, you know, expected to see some radical changes and to see a lot of the former national boundaries rewritten. So to see this all come to, you know, all of this come to pass is, you know, on one hand, it's expected. On the other hand, it's profound, and it's actually unfolding right in front of us. That the ancient sort of, Seleucid dynasty, if you will, is being resurrected right before us. And so I personally expect that in the years ahead, we will see the Antichrist emerge out of this region. Now, one of the things that I've been pondering lately is the possibility that both Daniel 7 and Daniel 8, but in particular I'm focused on Daniel 8, although having historical significance with regard to the Medo-Persian Empire, that's the ram that's budding to the north, to the west, and to the south, and then who's overcome by this goat that comes from the west and comes across the earth to the east. And then out of which, after this conflict comes Antiochus Epiphanes, beyond having that historical significance, I've been looking at Daniel 8 and saying, really when you look at it, the angel says a few times, he says, this vision, Daniel, concerns the time of the end. He says, he repeats it very emphatically. He says, the vision concerns the time of the end. Now, what most commentators have done is they've said, well, the issue of Medo-Persia, the ram, and then the goat, that's historical. And then the section on Antiochus Epiphanes, that sort of has dual fulfillment, both historical and future, with regard to the Antichrist. But the angel doesn't make any distinction. He just says the vision concerns the time of the end. So the point is, if the entire prophecy has both historical and future fulfillment, then what that would mean is that one of the most significant events to unfold in the last days would be sort of the recapitulation of that ram budding to the west, to the north, and to the south. In other words, the ram being Iran. And so if that's the case, then we really have the perfect scenario setting up for there to be a regional Iranian war, where Iran sees its interests threatened, both in Syria and Iraq. And of course, that whole southern section of Iraq, from Baghdad all the way down south, is Shia-dominated, and Iran already pretty much controls that. But if these radical Sunnis are threatening that, then we could very well see, not just some advisors, Iranian advisors in Baghdad, but to see a full-blown war. And if that's the case, then, if we do see a major Iranian war, then I would expect to say, I would probably come right out and say, we need to be looking at Daniel 8, and then to say the next step in that prophecy unfolding would be probably a Turkish response. And Turkey, of course, Asia Minor, representing the region of which was, in many ways, the biblical Greece. Of course, you have the Macedonian, the European section of Greece. But the term there in Daniel is Javan or Yavan, which actually included the European as well as the Asian section, Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey. And then throughout most of the passages that are actually speaking of Turkey, it was actually the Seleucid dynasty. Again, Antiochus Epiphanes' dominion, if you will. And so first you have the Iranian war, then the Turkish war, and then out of the chaos and ashes of those wars, you have the Antichrist who arises as the little horn. And, again, it's speculation as to whether or not the entire prophecy of Daniel 8 is futurist or not, or if we're just to look for the Antichrist to arise as the little horn. But clearly, I think the scriptures are clear that the Antichrist begins small, and he arises to a place of prominence. So personally, I don't believe that we know who the Antichrist is. I don't believe there's anyone we could point to and say, this is the guy right now. Because what most people do is they point to someone who's prominent on the world scene, someone that they don't like, Obama or whoever it might be, and they go, this is the guy. But I think the scriptures are clear that the Antichrist will begin as a leader of small significance, and he'll emerge to become a leader of great significance out of that region where Antiochus Epiphanes formerly had his dominion.
Very good. So you pretty much answered my next kind of question about the Antichrist. Does anybody have any other comments or questions or thoughts at this point?
This is Jeff. I had a quick question for you. Joel, first of all, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate it. So what about this? There's some scriptures that talk about this guy called the Assyrian, the destroyer of nations, Assyrian. How do you see that?
Sure. Yeah, well, in the same way that you have scriptures that point to Jacob's epiphany, again, Daniel 8 and 11, and then you have these prophecies that speak of the Assyrian throughout Isaiah. Micah 5 is really probably one of the most prominent ones. You've got the Bethlehem-born Messiah, you know, but you, Bethlehem, that put the out of you, will come one for me who will be ruler, whose you know, origins are from ancient times and so forth. And then you see, everybody knows that, you know, sort of that verse, you know, that this was essentially cited when you had the Magi coming and heard those words, but Messiah can be born, and they go, you know, the Sadducees or the least said that Bethlehem. And so, you know, it sort of comes up around Christmas, the Messiah born in Bethlehem, but you skip forward just a few verses, and it says, he, you know, speaking of the Messiah, he will deliver us from the Assyrian, when the Assyrian invades our borders and marches into our land. So here you have a specific land, you know, of course, modern-day Israel, with borders, and the Antichrist, the Messiah, Jesus, the Messiah, is delivering Israel from the invasion of the Assyrian. Now, what's so fascinating about this is you say to any preterist, someone who believes that all prophecies done in the past, you say, when did Jesus fulfill this? You agree that Jesus is the Bethlehem-born Messiah. When did he deliver Israel from the invasion of the Assyrian? And I go,
right.
Oh, you know, they just have to come up with some spiritualized explanation. And it's clear that this is something that takes place in the future. So now the question is, what does the Bible mean when it refers to the Antichrist as the Assyrian? Now, some people will take that into a very, very literal, you know, fashion, say, well, he must be a bloodline physical Assyrian. And then others will just spiritualize it away to mean nothing at all. Oh, it just means a bad guy, you know, any evil resistor of God's people or something like that. And I think somewhere in between those two extremes of the hyper-literal physical bloodline interpretation and just sort of the meaningless spiritual interpretation, I think that historically Isaiah and Michael were using the primary evil enemy of their time, of course, Sennacherib, or one of the various Assyrian kings, as sort of the prototype for the Antichrist, and it points to the region from which the Antichrist will come, again, which is identical to the Seleucid dynasty, and as well as, by the way, Magog, and, you know, that, I know that's another big issue, but Gog is from Magog. Magog, again, is that same general region, Asia Minor, Syria, northern Iraq, that's all referring to the land of Magog in Ezekiel's day. And so I don't believe that the Antichrist has to be physically bloodline Assyrian, but I believe, again, that he will come from the region of Assyria. And you know, Assyria, once more, Assyria, Asia Minor, I call it the tri-state area. So you're dealing with eastern Turkey, as well as Syria and northern Iraq. So, you know, again, the scriptures are repeatedly pointing and telling the same story over and over again, but they're using different pictures to convey that story. And I think the Assyrian passages, the Assyrian prophecies, are just one more in the series that that address the region from which the Antichrist will come forward from.
Yeah, that makes good sense. My thought was, as far as I know, Assyria doesn't exist anymore, and I was wondering if that was what we call Syria now, and looking at the globe, it's north of Israel, and then you have Iran and Iraq to the east, and so we have kings of the north, we have this Assyrian guy, so I was just kind of wondering if, and I agree with you that it's the region, it's not, maybe not a specific person, but the kings of the north, how do you see that? I was thinking maybe that was from, you know, what we call Syria today.
Well, you know, and that's the thing, and this is what people do a lot, is they look at the modern-day nation states and they try to just pick one and say, well, Syria must be modern-day Assyria. Of course, Assyria, Syria sounds the same. But the truth is, Assyria was probably closer to modern-day Iraq. Again, Nineveh was the capital of ancient Assyria. which again is, you know, right there, Mosul, right in the heart of Iraq. So, you know, and what's interesting is now you have the new Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which much more aligns with the ancient Syrian Empire. And so some people have said, well, maybe there'll be a new Kurdistan in the last days. Kurdistan will be the fulfillment of this sort of end time Assyria. And it looks as though we will have a Kurdistan, but then you have this new Islamic State, which probably much closer matches sort of that Assyrian Empire. But again, what I caution against is limiting your interpretation based on present-day national boundaries, because as we've just seen, they can change overnight. And I believe that after a few wars, I believe a lot of those national boundaries will change. And so, you know, we need to sort of stick with the picture that the scriptures are pointing to, and then we just sit back and watch. And modern-day events and national boundaries will align to what the scriptures say, which, you know, they always do. Israel didn't exist. We said, that's okay. The scriptures say in the last days they will. Sure enough, today Israel exists. And, you know, there were men of God who were simply taking the Bible for what it says at face value hundreds of years before Israel existed. And they just said, the scriptures say it's going to happen. And they nailed it. You know, it's interesting. If you get in arguments online with different people or whatever, they'll always say, oh, you guys talk about the end times. You know, you always just come up with new predictions. You never get them right. Well, that's true when it comes to the end of the world. You know, if you've got somebody who's trying to set a date, yeah, you've got plenty of people that missed it. But they never point out the guys, you know, and I've listed about a dozen different expositors that were hundreds of years beforehand confidently, adamantly declaring that Israel would be repatriated against all natural circumstances. They said, this is going to happen. And they nailed it, you know, and they weren't prophets. They were simply looking to this prophetic scriptures. And so whenever people do that, oh, you guys never get it right, we really need to throw that back in their faces and go, no, we do get things right when we hold to what the scriptures say and we don't get off into goofiness, which some people obviously do. You know, Harold Camping and so on and so forth. And so we just need to sort of take that approach as what do the scriptures say? In time, world circumstances will align to what the scriptures say. Sorry if I just got off on a tangent there.
No, that's great. I tend to agree with you on everything you said there. Final just kind of summation is, who do you see the kings of the north, the quote, kings of the north, as any specific northern region, north of Israel, or just that whole region again?
Okay. So you have two things. You have the king of the north, which is Daniel 11. I believe the king of the north is the Antichrist. And when you follow the entire chapter of Daniel 11, you have the historical conflict between Antiochus, Seleucid kings, of which Antiochus was the eighth, and they were in conflict with the Ptolemaic kingdom itself, which was Egypt. So really, Seleucid dynasty, just think basically Turkey, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Iran, think that whole northern swath of the Middle East, in conflict with Egypt. And it's going through the historical conflict, and then all of a sudden it shifts to the end times. And in verse 40 it says the king of the north will, you know, engage in battle with the king of the south. Well, what a lot of interpreters have done is they've tried to insert a third character suddenly, you know, sort of in violation of the flow of the whole chapter. They've tried to insert a third character and say, no, the Antichrist is at war with these two different kings, the king of the north and the king of the south. When they insert the Antichrist as a third player, they completely violate the flow of the entire chapter. And when you go back to the earliest church writers, these early premillennialists like Hippolytus, Lactantius, Victorinus, these guys that were, to give us expositions of Daniel, they all said that the king of the north was the Antichrist, of which, again, Antiochus Epiphanes was sort of the prototype. And so I believe the king of the north, once more, is it came from that same region. Seleucid dynasty, Assyria, the king of the north, these are all references that are all harkening back to that same region. But then you have the reference to the kings of the north. Now, the Antichrist is alarmed because he hears news with regard to the kings of the north. And so that's just a general vague reference, and to be honest, I would see that as probably already dealing with Turkey, Syria, Iraq, Iran. The only thing left that's north of that is Russia. And now this gets into the whole issue of Gog Magog, because a lot of people try to say that Ezekiel 38:39 is speaking of Russia. There's tremendous problems with that perspective. The least of which is that in Ezekiel's day, you know, the approach that we take to interpret the various names that are in Ezekiel's prophecy is what's called the grammatical historical perspective, which is to say, what did the names mean to Ezekiel and his immediate audience? Well, in Ezekiel's day, this was referring to Asia Minor, Syria, and that, again, that whole region of the north, Middle East, that whole northern swath of the Middle East. Now, years later, 800 years later, Josephus refers to Magog as the Scythians, which then migrated up to Russia. And so people go, you know, that Magog became the Russians. They start doing this sort of historical wild goose chase, trying to trace all these peoples down through history. The problem is, and again, I'm not picking on anyone, but you look at the writings of Hal Lindsey, you look at Joel Rosenberg's exposition of these things, and what they do is they sort of play that historical wild goose chase with Magog, and they say, well, that's Russia, but they don't do it with any of the other names. And so they limit the other names to Middle Eastern peoples, Turkey, Iran, this and that, but they sort of, they trace Magog down through history, and it's almost like a card trick where they use an inconsistent method of interpretation. If we simply stick with the grammatical historical perspective, then we're dealing with Middle Eastern nations, that Magog is referring to Turkey, Syria, Iraq, that whole region. And so I don't believe that Ezekiel 38:39 is speaking of Russia. If you want to say it's speaking of Russia, then you have to do that with all the other names. And so, for instance, Gomer is another one of the names. The Gomerites became the Gimari, which became the Sumerians, which became the Gauls and the Celts. So instead of, you know, the coming Russian invasion of Israel, you have to say the coming Irish invasion of Israel. You have to essentially include all of the Western world along with Russia. No one does that because it doesn't fit. I guess I'll say that Ireland is not the political boogeyman of our day, and so Russia is. So it's convenient to point to Russia as the enemy, but again, it's an inconsistent interpretation of the passage. I believe that Ezekiel 38:39 is pointing to the same thing that Daniel 11 is pointing to, the same thing that Micah 5 is pointing to, the same thing that really all of the prophets are pointing to. They're all telling the same general story.
Yeah, great. I think that makes good sense. Thank you very much.
Hi, Jeff. This is Tom. Could I say something?
Oh, sure.
When it was mentioned about the king of the north being hearing something that troubled him, it mentions that it was ships from Kittim that were coming from the western coastlands. So it's not north from Jerusalem, it's west. And these ships are coming from the western coastlands, which if you go directly west from Jerusalem, you're going, what?
You've got both. You've got the ships from Kittim, which would be initially, you know, Cyprus, but it later came to refer to the west. Yeah, you've got that one reference, but you also have a reference to the kings of the north and the armies from the east. So you've actually got three separate scriptures speaking of three separate threats, if you will. But it's the kings of the north that caused him to strike out in rage and start lashing out in a rage. The ships of Kittim seem to be something that take place earlier in the midst of his conquest.
Are you trying to associate the king of the south with the beast or the Antichrist?
No, the king of the south would be Egypt throughout the entire all of Daniel 11. The king of the south is referring to the Ptolemaic dynasty, which is essentially not just Egypt, but essentially Egypt and as well as a bit of modern-day Sudan and Libya as well. And then the king of the north, again, is the various Seleucid kings, of which Antiochus becomes the most prominent of them. And then in verse 40 is where it shifts, and it specifically says, in the end times, in the last days,
ships from Kittim, Reaper, all the way over to the United States. It was a family, one of the sons of Noah, the Japheth. His descendant family was Kittim, that were great shipbuilders, world travelers. They traveled all the way to the United States. They didn't stop in Sicily. So it's referring to the United States interfering in the Middle East.
It could very well. It could be, it could be an American-European alliance. In general, the reference to Tim, goes all the way back to Numbers 24. Chittim or Kittim, it could refer, it could just be a general reference to the West, or it could be very specific to the United States, or it could be some combination thereof.
There's another neat prophecy, I can't remember, in Deuteronomy, or maybe Numbers, where it talks about Kittim again, and it talks about the Kittim wanting to rescue Jerusalem because it had been attacked by Syria. And it says because Kittim gets in this mess, it also gets hurt. It's literally like, you do this,
right,
I'll do that, and you get knocked down too. So it's...
Right. Numbers 24.
The prophecy.
Numbers 24. Let me pull it up here.
And then Joel, how
much? Numbers 24:24. Go ahead.
Okay, I was going to ask you, how much time do you have, Joel? We'll stay on for a while, but I know that I don't want to keep you longer than you're able to. So, are you okay for another
sure,
little bit?
Yeah.
Okay, super.
I can give you 10-15 minutes.
Okay, super. So then maybe we'll finish this. I've got one other question. There was a question that was actually just emailed over as well, but it kind of ties in with the question that I had emailed to you. So maybe we'll hit that in just a minute then.
Sure. You want me to go ahead and touch on that? You've got how do I see the U.S. actually, which actually kind of rolls right into the previous discussion. How do I see the U.S. fitting into end time events? Is it end time Babylon?
Yeah, if you don't mind, if you want to finish like what you were on right there with Numbers 24, if you want to finish that real quick, and then we can go to that, that'd be great.
Oh, I'll just read the reference there in Numbers 24. It says, "A ship shall come from the coast of Kittim, and they shall afflict Ashur, or Assyria, and will afflict Eber, and so they will also come to destruction." It's part, Numbers 24, by the way, is a profound end time messianic prophecy that everyone should look at. It talks about the Messiah coming and destroying Edom and Moab, again, Middle Eastern peoples. But that becomes, probably the oldest reference to what may potentially be a last days. If you will, the West, Europe, the United States, again, we can't be overly dogmatic. But it could be any number of those seems to sort of come to its final defeat in the last days. With regard to the issue of where do I see the United States fitting in, my perspective with all of these things is there can be a tremendous danger with regard to the end times, which is where we approach the end times as though people just become dots on a map, on a sort of prophetic map, and they're sort of just pawns in a puzzle piece that we're trying to figure out. And I'm just always leery of saying, well, what's going to happen to us? People say, well, the United States is going to be destroyed, and they have different theories. In general, the fact of the matter is the Bible doesn't talk about the United States. There may be hints in places like what we just looked at, but for the most part, the point is the Bible is not focused on the United States. It's not about the United States. It's about Jerusalem. It's about Israel. The Bible is a thoroughly Jerusalem and Israel-centric book. Americans, everywhere I go and teach on prophecy, where's American Bible prophecy? And it really betrays, one, it's a very American-centric perspective that we have. We think that the world revolves around us, therefore the Bible's supposed to revolve around us. God's whole worldview should revolve around us as Australia or Norway. They don't say, well, you know, where's Norway in Bible prophecy? It's just really not part of their equation. So there's that issue, first of all, the Israel centricity of Scripture. Second, you know, all of us, I think, on the line are Americans. I don't know if there's any international Canadian college or something, but all of my children live in the United States. I live in the United States. And so, therefore, you know, this is a personal issue to me. So I don't like this to say, well, you know, we're going to be destroyed, or, you know, we're going to be nullified, or this sort of thing. I think that we need to approach this in a very real way, which is that we are called as the people of God, the intercessors. And so when the Scriptures are not absolutely crystal clear on some issue, we don't just passively sit back and sort of get into the fatalistic, deterministic prophecy mode and say, oh, well, we're just going to get annihilated. Our job is to intercede and be on our knees and cry out and say, Lord, have mercy on my nation. Lord, I ask that you would give my nation a revival, that we would have a legitimate spirit of repentance that would fall on the church, on the people of God. And, you know, it's just like if someone you love gets sick, you pray for them to get healed. Until they're dead, you don't stop. And so I see a lot of people in the church that have already given up. They've already completely given up on this nation. And believe me, it's tempting. When I look at the moral decay, when I look at the present political leadership, it's tempting to give up. But the bottom line is, I live here. The Lord has given, made me a steward of my sphere of influence. I'm going to continue to intercede. I'm not going to give myself over to some say, well, I think prophecy might say this, we're going to get wiped out. You know, whatever opinion anyone has, there's nothing that's crystal clear. And so we need to be intercessors. That's the first thing. This stuff is applicational. It's not just trying to figure out, decode, you know, the end time sequence of events and have our chart. That's the first thing. So the next point that I would make is, yes, there's various references that some people point to. There's, you know, there's this verse, or, well, what about the, you know, the wings of an eagle, and, you know, all these different things. Again, I don't think any of them are crystal clear. So again, I would just express caution. Is America Babylon? There's a handful of different theories and opinions with regard to the identity of Babylon. I think the United States is probably the least biblical of all of them. You know, when you look at, you can look at Revelation 17 and 18, and you can see elements of it that you can go, wow, that reminds me of the United States, or that reminds me of New York City, or reminds me of Hollywood, you know, the influence, the corruption, this sort of thing. But when you go through all of the various specifics that are listed in those two chapters, you lay out all of the biblical criteria, the United States simply does not line up with several of those. Now, we may line up with others, but there are several that it doesn't line up with. And one of the things that really sticks out that I find that very few people ever highlight is the simple fact that Mystery Babylon is portrayed as being in a desert. You know, the dawn is taken up, and he's shown this harlot city that's specifically in a desert. And it's as though we write that whole picture off. And, oh, that's just sort of that just speaks of barren, spiritual barrenness or something. No, it's a very literal picture. The woman's in a desert in the same way that he's shown Mount Zion, which is on a mountain, Mount Zion, is a very literal geographic picture. The woman is in a desert, and so of the other three primary interpretations that people have looked at is Jerusalem, and then, of course, literal Babylon, and then the city of Mecca or Saudi Arabia. At least those other three are all in a desert. At least those three geographically match the description there. Then the next thing that I think rules America out is that the two primary descriptions consistently throughout Revelation 17 and 18 are that he is, one, a religious and economic corrupting system. And she's clearly portrayed as a religious system. The very title across her forehead that says Babylon, mother of all harlots, this is, first of all, a very Middle Eastern expression, and it's widely misinterpreted, I find, by many in the West. The way that many people read that is they go, well, it's as though she's the great harlot, the great prostitute that gives birth to a bunch of little prostitutes, like she's the mother prostitute. That's a complete misreading of the statement. When in the Eastern mindset, when it says the mother of all harlots, what that means Times is the biggest, the greatest, most significant of all. Just like years ago when Saddam Hussein said, you know, this is going to be the mother of all battles. It's the big mama. And so, you know, when it says the mother of all harlots, what that means is it's the greatest, most significant harlot in human history. And a harlot is simply a false religion. It is an idolatrous religious system that pulls away worship from the one true creator God, the God of the Bible, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so, you know, clearly, and there's, you know, various other elements of the text that point to her being a religious system. The United States, for all of its corrupting influence of the earth through, again, Hollywood, and you can say she's certainly a great economic corrupting force in the earth, there's no question. The United States is not a religion, nor does it represent a religious system, nor is it primarily a religious influence in the earth. Yes, you know, we are great missions. We're, in fact, the greatest nation in the world in terms of spending the gospel, you know, throughout the earth. But we're not a religious system. The United States doesn't fit that. Secondly, the United States is not even close to being a city, which is the primary, you could say, a megalopolis, a mega city that she's portrayed as. Then there's an element that says this entity is responsible for all the blood of the saints and the death of the prophets and the saints. Again, the United States is not primarily a martyring entity that martyrs the people of God throughout the earth. So there's a handful of the criteria, I think, that when you look at the scriptures, that the United States simply doesn't align with. Now, you know, again, there's some popular books out there right now that are promoting the idea, and, you know, I think it's sensational and it sells well, and you've actually got a handful of books that are encouraging all people, all Christians or all followers of the Lord, to leave the country, and there's actually books on how to get out of the country claiming that, you know, I'm out for my people, but if you're a follower of God, you're supposed to leave the United States. Personally, I think that's silly. You know, again, I could get into all of the other, you know, we could deal with Jerusalem, we could deal with Mecca, we could deal with literal Babylon. I'm somewhere in between the idea that it's the city of Mecca or Jerusalem. I think that there's a handful of reasons to say Jerusalem has some very strong, you know, arguments in its favor, that it has some pretty strong arguments against it as well. Probably the most significant of which is that after the destruction of Babylon, it says that Babylon, you know, whatever this entity is, will be desolate forever. It will be essentially a wasteland, never to be inhabited again, a place, a haunt for jackals and owls and desert creatures. And never again will there be heard the voice of those that were just married or commerce and this sort of thing. So it's a place of complete desolation. And so it's very, very difficult to reconcile the idea that Jerusalem is going to be the location where Jesus returns to rule the nation, that everything culminates in Jerusalem, but to try to reconcile that with the idea that it's going to be desolate forever. So that's a huge problem. What it has, what that argument has in its favor is that, you know, repeatedly throughout the prophets, Jerusalem is the place where all the prophets are killed. You know, Jesus says, you know, never does a prophet ever die outside of Jerusalem. And here you've got this description that says that history of Babylon is the place that's filled with the blood of the prophets, the martyrs, the saints. So that's a difficult one to get around.
Okay, I got a question for you then. Then Paul, do you consider Paul, the Apostle Paul, a prophet?
Yeah,
because he died in Rome, and we know that Peter probably died in Rome. So here we have, because all of them died in Rome, in Jerusalem before Jesus, doesn't mean that afterwards that they would. Because what was the commission? The commission was to go out into all the world.
Right. Yeah,
okay,
no,
okay, thank you. I just wanted to point out that many of the as the Catholicism was during the Dark Ages, now called the Middle Ages. When I went to school, it's called the Dark Ages, which is more fitting description because most records were destroyed by the Catholic Church during that time because of the horrors of what they did. And what was left, we know that they there were many, many prophets that they burned because they didn't think they could go to heaven if they were burned. And they burned them alive often. And so, anyway, go ahead. I'm listening. Thank you.
Sure. No, that's an excellent, excellent point. You know, and I know, you know, if you're coming from a Seventh-day Adventist background, that, you know, everything is on loan. Now, I will say this. 1 Peter 5, 13, Peter, who was writing arguably from Rome, in fact, all of the, like across the board, every early church writer said that Peter was in Rome. He said, she who is in Babylon, in the King James, she who is in Babylon, doth greet thee, you know, as does Marcus, my son. And so the idea is that Peter was using the term Babylon to refer to Rome as a code word. And in fact, there are a few other first century, second temple, pseudepigraphical words, you know, non-canonical, non-scriptural texts, such as the Sibylline Oracles, Second Esdras, and I believe Baruch as well, that all referred to Rome at that time as Babylon. So it was both a Jewish and a Christian or Messianic Jewish, you know, they refer to Rome as Babylon. Now, in my opinion, Babylon is a concept that migrates, and it refers to the capital of essentially Satan's stronghold in the earth at any given time. So I believe in the first century, Rome, the Empire of Rome, was the reigning beast empire, and thus Rome was the stronghold of Satan in the earth. It was the financial and the spiritual capital of Satan in the earth. You know, of course, Babylon itself, originally the capital of Babylonia, was once, you know, that was the prototype, obviously, for Mystery Babylon. But in the first century, it was Rome. Today, I believe that the greatest city of idolatry in the earth, really in the history of mankind, 1.6 billion people, 5 times a day, bowing for the city of Mecca. I don't believe there has ever been in the history of mankind a city of idolatry that has garnered the idolatry of more people globally than the city of Mecca. It is the greatest capital of the worship of Satan in the history of mankind. Now, again, that's not to diminish the fact that Rome was, and in many ways still is, you know, a city of idolatry, and you could point to many other cities of idolatry, but in terms of the greatest, in terms of the mother of all harlots, particularly in our day, in the last days, I believe that Mecca is that. And then when you look at the kingdom of the Saudi kingdom, hands down, this is the greatest source of financial backing of radical Islam throughout the earth. And when you look at every American president, going back to the last several, whether it's the Bushes, whether it's Clinton, whether it's Carter, all of them, open, they've received tens of billions of dollars directly from the Saudi princes, the Saudi kings. And, you know, you say, why? Why does someone give someone several million dollars if they're not looking for something? And really, you don't have anybody, and you know, this is one of the primary descriptions throughout Revelation 17, 18, is that she lives in luxury. She glorifies herself, you know, in ways that are just beyond description. There's nobody, you can't point to a, you know, American sports star or, you know, a rapper, a musician, or even, you know, Donald Trump, you know, a real estate mogul or a president throughout the earth that live in the excess of luxury as the Saudi princes and kings, the degree of luxury that they lavish on themselves. And again, it's all funded by us, by the Western world, and by oil, and the amount of influence that they spread. And they pay for the radical hate preachers throughout the earth. They pay for the imams. They pay for the Islamic centers in the mosques. No matter where you are in your city, I guarantee you can find a mosque that was funded and paid for. The greatest antichrist religion that mankind has ever known. You know, it, you know, with Catholicism, you know, there, as a Protestant, obviously, there's huge issues that I disagree with. But by the same token, they still did stand firm, you know, long before the Protestant Reformation in terms of defending the divine incarnation of God in Christ. They stood firm in defending
Let me ask you this.
Sure.
Let me ask you one thing. Are you a Sabbath keeper?
Am I a Sabbath keeper?
Yes.
No.
In other words, not a first day keeper, or are you a seventh day keeper, I should say?
I mean, I'm not a Saturday Sabbath keeper.
Okay. Yeah, because that's okay. Then I won't try to go there right now.
That's a big issue. But
yeah, that's the issue. That what happened is how we see Babylon is the whore, the Catholicism, because they it bows to idols, which we know that their prayers go to Mary, their prayers go to Saint Christopher, Saint Paul, Saint John, whoever, and we also know that. That out of this came the Reformation, which was started with basically in our time periods. It started successfully with Martin Luther, and then the Church of England, and with a few other nations that were able to break away from Catholicism. And then so we see them as they were the start of the Reformation, which took people out of the fact that we were saved by grace and not by works. You know. You couldn't buy your way to heaven.
Sure. Yeah.
You, the 95 theses basically on the wall at Wittenberg, which was mostly everything was against the, what did they call that? Where you buy your way to heaven. Indulgences. Thank you. Yes. So anyway, at that point, we need to, and then so we feel, the Adventist Church feels that the Christian churches have been given the opportunity to see that the Ten Commandments are binding. Therefore, we believe that the Protestants give homage to the Catholicism by keeping that day. Now, those that are ignorant of it have no condemnation by God. You know, there's that unknown sin that was even in the Old Testament. If you didn't know your sin, you were in no problem. God would cover that. But once you understood that it was a sin, then it was your responsibility to step up. And so, as Adventists, we see that as people become acknowledgeable of the Sabbath Sunday question, and we believe that the two-horned ram naturally, and it's going to make everyone, when the United States passes the Sunday law, it'll force everyone, because it's in a position of great power, to force other nations to follow the papacy, which wants the Sunday law.
So, I mean, I fully understand the whole, you know, Seventh-day Adventist worldview and eschatology. I really do. But let me just pose this to you. Now, again, you know, just in terms of, you know, as a Protestant, you know, we're in agreement on everything, you know, except for some issues. But you've got roughly 1 billion Catholics worldwide, and probably, you know, who knows what percentage are devout or even pray. But you've got... that now pushing double that amount of Muslims in the earth, who, you know, according to 1 John 2:22, it says, this is the spirit of the end. Who is the liar? It is the one that denies that Jesus is the Son of God. It denies that Jesus has come in the flesh. It says, it denies the Father and the Son. Now, the Catholic Church, again, you know, you could have the issue of the Sabbath, you could have, you know, a lot of theological issues. But they affirm the Father and the Son. You have the Islamic religion, which in their holy book, in their Quran, actually says, if you say that Jesus is the Son of God, that you're the most grievous blasphemy that anyone can utter. And probably several verses it directly says, do not say that Jesus is the Son of God. So you have this book, which is a specific polemic against all of those things that we hold as central, the fact that Jesus died on the cross, the fact that he is God, all of these things. And it says, if you believe those things, that you're absolutely going to hell. Now, again, it's not to belittle or diminish the conflict that we have with Catholicism, but what I'm saying is, which one is worse? And which one, now again, you can say, well, the Catholics are going to start beheading people again or something. Who's beheading people in the earth right now? You know, when you look at the apple of God's eye, the center of all biblical prophecy, where it culminates, where Jesus returns, where he's going to establish his throne from the earth. And you say, you know, go which entity, which ideology completely holds sway over that entire region? Which is more threatening, the Catholic Church or the Islamic world?
And but so you understand,
is, you know, again,
you understand that the mark of God's saints is that they keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. So God's people are not the Jews there that do not keep the faith of Jesus. You know what? We got so much back. Hold on. We got so much background noise. I don't know if Jeff, you can do anything about that.
I might have to meet everybody out, but. And Joe, I know you gotta head out anyway, so
Sam's actually wrong.
Yeah.
Okay. Everybody just mute your line. Hit R6. Not you, Joel, but if anybody that might have any noise, hit R6 to be safe.
I have a hard time hearing. I just hear a bunch of background noise.
Yeah. Okay, I think I'm gonna go ahead and mute everybody out, and then it'll just be you and I, Joel, and we'll just kind of wrap it up, and then I'll unmute everybody, and we'll stay on, and we'll continue to talk about some of this stuff, but it's actually pretty quiet now, so do you want to finish that real quick? I know you got to go, so just, you know, give us about a one-minute warning, and we'll let you roll.
Okay, yeah, let me just finish by saying, you know, of course, in Israel today, the majority of the Jews, of course, are hardened. And they're not, you know, in the faith, and the people don't go to heaven just because they're Jews. But Paul makes it very clear in Romans 11 that though they are presently enemies of the gospel, they are still beloved. And that election and calling on Israel remains, that the callings of God are irrevocable, and that when Jesus returns, as I read 12, they will look upon the one they have pierced. Jesus says all the tribes of the earth will mourn. Revelation. One, it says he's coming on the clouds, all the tribes of the earth will see him. And so in that day, Paul makes it clear that all Israel that is left will turn to him and convert when he returns. And so he continues, the Lord continues to look to Israel as his people, even though they are not his people, you know, in the faith right now. So, yes, of course, we are allowed to be grafted in, but Paul says don't look down arrogantly on the branches that have been cut off, because if you do, you'll be cut off yourself. And this is probably the most significant warning that Paul makes. He doesn't just say, you know, if you look down arrogantly at the Jews, you might miss a blessing. He actually says you can be cut off. So I would just end it by saying, you know, this is a big, big issue that we need to be aware of. You know, the Israel centricity, the ongoing election, the calling of God, and why the nations gather against Jerusalem. The reason Satan gathers against Jerusalem is because God's not done with them. In other words, if God's done with Israel, Satan certainly has not received a memo. And we need to, you know, essentially Satan is bearing witness to God. He's bearing witness to the redemptive purposes of God in the last days. And I believe that so much to what's taking place throughout the Middle East, the constellation of the nations, it's circling around that city, around Jerusalem. And that's because Jesus is going to come back and rule the earth from Jerusalem. And by the grace of God, we get to be part of that when it comes to issues like the Sabbath, Torah, all of those things. When he returns, the thing is that we're not going to be arguing about it anymore. And we'll all be in full agreement because we'll have him as our teacher. And the Torah of Messiah will go forth from Jerusalem, and all the nations will go up each year to celebrate Sukkot and to listen and to be taught by him directly. And I'm looking forward to that day. So
amen.
It was wonderful to be here with y'all. And I'm sure we can do it again sometime.
Amen.
Thank you, Joel.
Hey, Joel, thank you.